This is The Biz of Wealth. Challenges, rumblings, and evolution of the wealth management industry.
Welcome again. Today I had the pleasure of speaking to Michael Venuto, an ETF industry veteran with over a decade of experience in the design and implementation of ETF-based investment strategies. Michael is the managing director of Tidal Growth Consultant and the co-founder and chief investment officer of Toroso Investment. Before that, he was the head of investments at Global X Funds, where he provided portfolio optimization services to institutional clients. Michael was instrumental in the establishment of multiple strategic investments and partnerships related to the ETF industry, and he was chosen as one of the ETF.com All-Stars for his research and is often quoted as an ETF expert in a wide array of publications. We had a lot of fun talking about the evolution of wealth management in general and the markets in particular in these turbulent times. So I hope you enjoy. Without further ado, here we go. Okay, Mike, thank you for being here. We know each other for a long time, so I'm not going to take that long into introductions and go right into, you know, a quick question that is like, what got you here and what's here?
Yeah, I like how you asked the question, because it's like, if I don't answer the first one, the second question first, then I get lost. But where is here? Today, I run a company with my partner, Guillermo Trias, called Toroso Investments. And basically, we wanted to become the thought leaders in the ETF space, you know, from how to use them, how to pick them, how to build them, how to launch them, how to market them. We try and cover everything through our various different brands. When you're talking finance, everybody always goes to numbers. So I think today we're like 2.6 billion. We have the biggest blockchain fund and the best performing mutual fund of ETFs out there. Well, best performing mutual fund out there, but it's a mutual fund of ETFs. And we have our think tank, and we've helped companies like SoFi and Blue Cross Blue Shields launch ETFs. So that's what here kind of looks like. We're a small business with 21 employees in 7 different states. How I got here? Well, I had worked on Wall Street for 13, 14 years in the traditional big banks and hedge funds. And I just watched all the innovation and transparency get washed out. Yeah. And starting Toroso for me was about embracing creative and financial freedom for our clients and for our families. And we've tried to live it that way. The road was not a linear straight line. It was a lot of bumps, which you participated in some of that up and down with us. You know, figuring out who our client was, figuring out what our value prop is. But we are here now.
Yeah. So. And one thing that I've seen always about you guys, you've always been authentic and very big on, you know, the life work balance too. You mentioned families, and that's one thing that it's always been part of the core values of Toroso that I've seen. So.
Absolutely true. In terms of our messaging and how we interact with our clients and our employees, not so easy for Guy and myself.
To actually do it.
I did just take 2 days off and I went fishing every day with my kids. And, you know, we're in New York City or New York, Long Island. So we're like 13 weeks into quarantine. So at this point, to have 2 children or 3 children, depending on which ones want to go on the boat together, is like a nightmare. So yesterday I took each one of them for an hour separately, and it was like the great relaxing fishing trips. You know, like they almost like us at this point, they want some personal time, right? They're on top of each other in a house for 13 weeks.
Yeah.
There's a lot worse things going on out there, but that work-life balance, super important. I wish that I personally would embrace it a little bit better, because it's kind of the reason we're doing this as a company.
Right, exactly. Actually, since this whole thing started, the first thing that I thought about was, okay, you know, we see there is this pandemic. Everybody started with the health issue and how, you know, it's a very severe health issue for everybody. But I kept thinking, you know, the greatest impact of all this in the long term is not only the economy, which, you know, much better than I do, but also the mental health impact on every single person, and kids too. I see like they need to get out. They keep asking about their friends. They keep asking, like, when am I going to be able to play it again? And that's definitely.
So we came up with an idea. So although most of my family is actually in Florida, close to where you are, my wife's family is all here in New York, like within 5 miles. Two sisters and a brother and cousins and all. And so it's been difficult to have everybody separate because they're used to seeing each other every weekend. So what we did is we went on Amazon and we bought a 16-foot movie screen for the backyard.
Right?
It was pretty cheap. It's inflatable, like a blow up.
Yeah,
like,
I've seen them.
Christmas decorations. And so we've been doing movie nights in the backyard, and I used like rope lights to mark out areas for the families. So like they're 10, 15 feet apart, sitting in beanbag chairs in the dark, watching Gremlins or Guardians of the Galaxy, or we watch Back to the Future, all the old 80s movies. We're doing Clue on Friday. But it's like we're able to get two families together, but we're literally 10 feet apart for 2 hours outdoors watching a movie. So innovation, that's the best
exactly.
we got, and we're pretty appreciative of it, you know. But at the same time, the kids are scared. I mean, you know, the protest now is another scary situation, because the kids, they just see they walk by, they see the news is showing the looters, not the protesters.
Yeah.
And so in the midst of having to explain to them a global pandemic, now I have to explain to them something even harder, what protesting means and what the difference is between protesting and looting. And like, because immediately they think these are bad people. And I had to like stop my son. I'm like, these are not bad people. These are people who need to be heard. And, you know, so like, it's gone from some of the other kids at school being the bad influence to the news is the bad influence.
I've been going through that too. And it's that's unfortunate. The media part is a whole other conversation that we'll be going rabbit hole. But okay, getting back to wealth management in general, like, first of all, no, I wanted to ask you this question that we had started. What is the best compliment you have ever received in your career or in your life?
So I guess I jumped ahead. So the best compliment I've ever got is from my son telling me I'm the best fisherman there ever has been, right? So like it's all finance, it's all everything. And I'm like, oh, yes, so great. And the very next day, he got mad at me for something else. And he told me that I'm so terrible that not even my mother would like me. So he definitely, I thought I'd throw in the best compliment and best attack. Like from the business world, I would say the best compliment was probably from Guillermo, my partner, when he said, I'm in this company because of you. And that's like him explaining that he trusts me with better words than saying, I trust you.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so now that we've been through, we haven't been through it yet. So we're in the midst
now that we're in the midst of the apocalypse.
Yeah, we're in the midst of the apocalypse. Who's going to survive?
So this is real important if we get to the nuts and bolts of finance. There's a big difference between business survival and investment survival. And I feel the dislocation at this point is so extreme. So I can think back to early March when this all started to be pervasive in the markets. And we immediately lobbed onto this idea of zombies. Okay, zombie companies to us, we defined them as 25 of the 160 industries out there that without government assistance will not survive as public companies. So let me make this really clear. Things like Sign Property Group, a real estate mall operator, or American Airlines or JetBlue, or Ruth Chris Steakhouse, these things, their business is gone, right? Like, it's gone. It will come back. But that doesn't mean the investors that are in them as public companies will be made whole. And I try and remind people of 2008. In 2008, they saved the clients of Bear Stearns, the employees of Bear Stearns, not as Bear Stearns employees, but as JP Morgan employees. But at the end, it was a prepackaged bankruptcy or takeover, right? The Bear Stearns shareholders got 2%. They didn't get everything back. The same went with Lehman. Similar things happened with Ford and GM. Similar things happened with GE and AIG. These were big, important companies in our world. And the businesses survived. The shareholders were not kept whole. So the first wave of stimulus that we got in early March, it was so extreme, right? Like, in 2008, it took them 12, 13, 14 months to put out money like that. They put it out in like days, and it was necessary because it was about stopping panic. Okay. In order for the physical mall of Simon Property Group to really survive, we're going to need three or four of those. And eventually the taxpayers are going to be like, why are we saving these companies? Let them go bankrupt and let them start over. Right, like, or just keep operating. I mean, I've seen Toys R Us go bankrupt 18 times. So when you ask who's going to survive, it's the digital versions. It's everybody needs to stop talking about going back to where we were 4 months ago and start talking about the digital world, the new economy. Stop trying to go to Simon Malls and start thinking about owning Shopify, the digital mall. Right, like, I separate the two, zombies versus, we've called them both camels and bookshelves. Everybody's got a bookshelf in their background that's booming, or a camel can carry a lot of water and stay alive until this is over. It's not about the unicorns of the past. It's about staying alive and letting this work its way through.
How much of these do you think? Because I feel like every single zombie company that you mentioned, I read your report, it's about outdated business models too. How much of that, you know, I feel like they were dying a slow death.
Yeah.
Maybe the next 5-10 years, they were, you know, they were not making money, most of them, not significantly. And now the you know, the acceleration of that is basically what happened.
Yeah, so there's mega trends, right? And I would say this applies to a lot of the zombie companies, right? So hotels were being displaced by Airbnbs, commercial real estate, by WeWork. Now, none of it was working proper yet, right? Like when Uber first came out, it was not a threat to taxis for the first 5 years. Right. The technology has to work. The adoption has to work. It's all future. So a lot of things like digital payments, cybersecurity, gig economy, blockchain, these were all trends that were already happening and were already displacing brick and mortar face-to-face kind of companies. This pandemic definitely accelerated it. Now, the emerging markets, super far ahead of us because they've gone through pandemics like this before, right? So like the SARS virus didn't affect us the way it affected the emerging markets. JD, one of the largest e-commerce companies in China, was created in response to the SARS virus. So yes, the zombies were already infected.
they were already zombies. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, but you do throw in there certain restaurants that are experiences and things. the changing business models like Starbucks, you know, the way right now Starbucks is quasi in that zombie category. But they think about it differently. They embrace different ways to do it. I don't think airlines will disappear, and I don't think they were being quite displaced, but I don't see how, when this is over, if it ever ends, that we have 10 or 15 public airline companies. It doesn't seem likely to me. And what's amazing is the airline ETF, which never had more than like 70 million in it, it went over a billion today because everybody is, they call it bottom fishing. It's crazy. It breaks every rule, right? It breaks every rule, but it does show that ETFs are the way that people prefer to take those bets, right? Rather than them go buy 10 airlines, they buy this one ETF.
So you basically, can we use that analogy and the zombies analogy in, you know, applying to the wealth managers' business models? Where do you see that going?
So I think if we apply it to the wealth management business model, it's more that their clients are zombies.
Okay. How's that?
Well, they still think that that the thing that's propping up many of these financial advisors that have been in the industry for, you know, 25, 30 years is they have a client base that doesn't question a lot of it, that isn't asking, why am I paying 1%? What am I getting for that 1%? They just assume this is how it's always been done. And if you talk to the new wealth transfer, they ask that question. So they go, okay, so my dad has 24 million with you. Okay. And you're charging him 1%. Why? If he had 2.4 million and you charge them 1%, are you doing something different? Cause they'll look at the actual number. They'll say, wait a minute, are you doing, he had 2.4 with you. That's 24 grand, but 24 million, 240 grand. What are you doing different for him? Are you doing 10 times the work, right? So what makes financial advisory so scalable is that fee structure. The new world of clients are asking, what am I getting for that fee? So what we've talked about a lot in our ETF think tank is that the financial advisor of the future is more of a life coach, because a lot of the investment part has become commoditized, right? So it's kind of that cyborg advisor, right? They use the robos and the content and everything. And then their real job becomes truly helping that client decipher what's going on and make good investment decisions. I mean, I know so many people that are investment professionals that are terrible at investing, right? They know what to do. They just can't execute. The financial advisor of the future is all about keeping somebody on path. One of our portfolio managers, Michael Guyad, who runs our rotation fund, he's got this saying, and I think it's so true. It's that it's more important to stay on a plan than what the plan is.
Right.
Right. And I, yes, and that's what the job of the financial advisor will, in my opinion, become. It'll be experience. It'll be not their personal experience, the experience they provide to their clients and how they educate them and what they become specialist in. I've seen Tyrone Ross talk a lot about, you know, you'll have a financial advisor that does your ESG. You'll have your financial advisor that does your ETFs or tax planning. Like, the specialist is the future. So
hyper specialization, yes, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And people will pay that 1% for it if they feel they're getting value.
So the other day we were talking and you mentioned how, you know, Toroso was actually built for this, for the pandemic and for the years after the pandemic. So walk me through that and why you think that, and how you've been innovative in your model.
We haven't had a physical office that everybody goes to for more than 5 years. Now we have physical offices, but they're really for meetings or whatnot. And it's because we did not want geography to limit our talent pool, right? Most of the, I don't even like to use the word employees, partners or team members, they're all specialists or have their own thing. And Taroso's become a platform for them to grow how they see things, right? Like Dan Weisskopf has his community and his writings, and David Jakansky has his research and the way he wants to get things out, and Gaiad has his fund, and Guy has his vision, and Eric has his vision. And so rather than limit ourselves by geography, we just embraced technology early on. So we've been using GoToMeeting, Zoom, Doodle, Calendly, Slack, you name it, yeah. High-flying tech name, we've been using that sort of tech since the beginning. I mean, I have so many notes on it, on how we do it, but it really is about pretending like you're all in there physically by having a constant chat going and Slack going, by having standing meetings. Like, I hate Mondays, but Mondays is our office day, right? So Monday starts with Guy, Mike, and Dan doing an hour meeting, and then going to the consulting meeting, the investment meeting, the CFO meeting, the marketing meeting. So, and there's different parts of our 21 people across seven states on each of those meetings. And then we go through the week with, you know, constant communication. And so, although we didn't build Taroso for this environment, we built it for the environment that we think the world is going to, where, you know, your physical location shouldn't limit your ability to grow something beautiful and achieve that financial and creative freedom.
But also the, you know, the ETF think tank, the way you envisioned it, it never had, you know, an in-person component. You started, you know, putting together people, ETF. Well, you tell me better than I do, but
yeah,
with financial advisors.
So the ETF think tank was kind of a personification of all of our research ideas into a digital platform that allows us to connect with advisors. Okay. And we've always connected with our advisors online instead of, you know, having wholesalers go out and talk to them and buy them golf balls and steaks. So what's been really interesting for us is watching everybody else try and catch up to that. And the fact that the advisors that have embraced the use of the think tank for the last 6-8 years, all of a sudden when this happened and they couldn't physically talk with other resources, they already knew how to engage with us. So, you know, for the last couple of years, we've been doing 35 to 55 meetings a month with advisors, helping them either with their social media, their thought leadership, their portfolios, their marketing plan, their investment plan, their IPS, whatever. In the last 2 months, we've been averaging more like 75 to 100 meetings because it flipped. Now there is no other resource. So the way we've communicated internally is also how we've communicated externally. We produce a lot of transparent content and we engage advisors to help them grow their business. My tagline there is our value prop is to enhance yours. I truly believe that. And luckily we have good sponsors that pay for all that. But yeah, we're helping a lot of advisors navigate this.
How do you see the ETF issuers survive the pandemic? Do you see them affected by this or not?
Just like everybody else in early March, we lost some of our biggest sponsors because everybody pulls back because nobody knows what's happening, right? Like, the world's messed up right now. But if you remember how you felt 3.5 months ago, it was like insanely intense and anxiety. So I think, you know, we've done a lot of research on this over the years. 3 months after every big market downturn, ETFs take in money. And it's just because market downturns take money out of the incumbent mutual funds the money that's been stuck there because they didn't want to pay taxes or whatever. And so they go to cash. When they come back in, they never go back to mutual funds. They always come back and start investing in ETFs. So I think market disruptions always end up benefiting ETFs 3-6 months later. The real question, though, is, you know, what can really hurt the ETF industry is the markets, right? Like, I don't think we're out of this. I look up on the screen and it's green every day. Right? We lost 3 months of production across our economy. There's more unemployment than anybody, almost anybody alive has ever dealt with. And the markets are down almost nothing on the year now. It doesn't make any sense.
Right. I was looking at that picture that's around social media, that it's like the front of the house is white and impeccable, and then the back of the house is completely burned down. And that's the markets versus the economy. So how do you explain that?
It's 100% government intervention. I mentioned it earlier. In 08, it took them 12 to 14 months to do nowhere near as much stimulus as they did this time in days. And the belief is, no matter what happens, the government's going to fix it. It makes no sense to me, because they hate, the general public seems to hate the government, distrust the government, and yet the markets seem to believe it. The dislocation here is absurd. We do a Zoom meeting every Thursday. We call it Get Think Tanked. And we had Jim Bianco on from Bianco Research. And he was postulating the thesis, what if in 12, 18 months, we're at 90% of what we were 4 months ago? And if you think about it, that's pretty optimistic. Like, that's a beautiful scenario.
Yeah.
Okay, but if you go do the math, that's a great recession. That's like 90% of where we were in terms of employment, in terms of GDP, and all those math numbers that you, when you work them out, that is a stock market that should be down 30 to 50%. That is an economy that is decimated and has a lot of work to do. So there is a lot of doom if you get past this idea that the government can save us. The reality is they'll just keep doing, the government will save us till they can't, till it stops working. And nobody knows when that day is.
Right. When do we stop issuing?
They won't. They will not stop issuing until they've issued so much that it just either doesn't work, like what happened in Japan years ago, or they devalue something so bad that we have bigger problems. To me, I have a slightly more optimistic view. I'm not worried about going back to where we were four months ago. I think everybody needs to stop talking about that and start thinking about what are the things that the new world could be like. Like, what is the new ways of doing commerce, of communicating, of digital events, of how do we go back to enjoying each other's company safely? Like, how do we do commerce safely? And it's not, using an app to do something we used to do. No, the future looks very different than what the present was 4 months ago. That innovation is what gets us out. It's not figuring out how to go back. It's not about making the economy great again. It's about making a new economy.
Manufacturing is really definitely.
Yeah, you can figure out my politics pretty quickly.
But actually, that takes me to one question that I had, because I used you as an example a lot, actually, with the happy hour you launched, mm-hmm. Right? You know, after the crisis, and I feel like that's a perfect example of combining technology with human connections. So what did you tell us about that?
So I'm gonna break out the background for it.
Yeah.
There you go. There you go. So we came up just organically, said, you know, the finance industry has always been somewhat very social, right? You you do business with people you know, with people you trust. It's very hard to develop trust if you don't have your circle of connections expanding. So for us, we had this idea, what if every Thursday we just got together and had a drink? Like we do have a drink. I usually have a coffee or a beer or sometimes a vodka, but and we invite somebody that's interesting to talk with us. It's a zero revenue model business thing for us. We just said, how do we have a social networking section? Like we're stopping at a bar to say hello and meet new people. So my ETF think tank team gets together every Thursday at 5 o'clock. We're completely open. And we've been averaging 150, 200 people every week just coming to have a drink and say hello. And if people want to talk, we unmute them and let them say it. But like, it's kind of weird to think that there's people in my industry that I usually see once a week, once a month. And many of us haven't seen each other for three months, going on 4 months. So to be able to see each other on Zoom and have a drink and talk about what's going on, it's been really nice. So I'll go back to the regular background, but leave the bar till Thursday.
And let the marketing me answer to that zero revenue remark you made. It's not zero revenue. Well, it is zero revenue in terms of cash coming in every Thursday. But that database that you're building every single Thursday, it is adding value to the company for sure.
We're not completely altruistic in it. Right. But if somebody wants to pay to be a sponsor, I'm sure we'll figure that out.
But
the reason we started it was to over communicate. Like that's been our theme all the way through this. As soon as this started, and look, we have ties to Spain because Guillermo's family's there, so we knew a lot ahead of time. We have clients in China, so we knew a lot that was going on ahead of time. The second everything started to shut down, we immediately called town hall meetings on GoToMeeting or Zoom with all of our team members and sat down and went over, here's all of our plans. This is our business continuity plan, which we've been living it for 5 or 6 years anyway, our business continuity plan. And we made this message of, we're just going to keep over-communicate internally, over-communicate with the clients. And we've been doing it nonstop, and it's been a bit exhausting, and that's why I needed 2 days off.
Yeah, that's for sure. But so let me tell you, how do we, translate this into a combination for your service offering, for wealth advisors or yourself? How do you find the perfect combination of or integration between technology and human touch that you need in the financial services to develop that trust, as you were saying?
Okay. So this, the amount of like fear that we see with most advisors here is amazing, because they're scared of disrupting their clients. They're scared of compliance. Like they think compliance is just they think the answer on compliance to anything social media is just a big stamp of no. It's not true. So I think it comes back to be authentic and then use the technology to deliver it. The first step is figuring out what's out there and what's working. So it's like we built an app where we'll ask about all the things you're doing to communicate and how you're using softwares and things like that. We have little swipes on it, and it gives us scores versus other advisors. And then we sit down with them and say, your trading systems, okay, these work, they're updated. Your social media systems, you've got 3 LinkedIn followers, wake up. This is the greatest free lead source in the world. What are you doing? I was afraid to comply. Just be authentic. You don't have to go on there and say, buy this stock. Go on there and say,
this is who I am.
Do you know that the tax deadline was delayed? Like, content is content. Give them bits of information that you would tell them on the phone. How are you scheduling meetings? Are you using Doodle? Like, most of Doodle's awesome, but most advisors are scared to death of it because the client's going to get a Doodle and go, what is this thing? Or Calendly or HubSpot, or like they get scared and they don't embrace it. I think probably, I mean, you pulled us along on some of these things over the years. And, you know, at first you're like, I just don't want to deal with the disruption. I don't want to deal with a disruption during a disruption, right? I think that they're surprised quite often that their clients or their clients' kids know the technology better than they do.
Right.
So, like, yeah. Make the phone call, have the discussion, say, I want to over-communicate, and here's ways that I can communicate with you more than just phone calls. Sign up with me. Get a daily thing. Get a weekly thing. Get whatever. Don't become a zombie.
Yeah, that's the conversation. Yeah, that's the conversation for every single wealth management thing right now. It's okay, how are you gonna wake up from not becoming a zombie?
And they have to do it right now because money is in motion, right? If you're an old school advisor and you haven't called your clients through this and given them something in, you know, to think about, or some, because you can't take them to play golf right now and you can't take them to a fancy dinner. So money is in motion. We're hearing advisors picking up big accounts, and it's a lot more the independent advisors that are communicating or have a social presence or in some way a specialist or an influencer. Those are the ones picking up accounts from the ones that, you know, stuck you in a model and did nothing throughout all of this.
Oh, okay. And how do you see that? Where, like, you see one of the main decision-making factors is that recognition right now?
The clients out there right now, they're home, a lot of them. They're scared. They're confused. And if you're not over-communicating with them, somebody else is.
Right. Somebody's helping them walk through this. Right.
Yes.
That's
okay. Right, they're coming to one of my Zoom meetings or drinks and listening.
Well, I signed up.
They're calling one of the advisors that came on and said something smart. And, you know.
Oh, they did.
Yeah. No, we've seen. We didn't know if it really worked, but some of our thought leader clients in the think tank are getting accounts from LinkedIn, from social media right now. Like it is happening. They're getting the meetings because the people that are usually knocking on those doors can't knock right now. So instead they're getting dripped on campaigns.
Yeah.
And they're responding.
It just works, right?
You know, the reason I think it's working more now is people have less interaction, so they're willing to look at it a little bit more. And number two, for many years, people weren't going to move their money because it didn't matter what you bought. The markets have just been going straight up, right?
Right.
So when you see these kinds of dislocations and people see these 30% drops, now they're open to hear a different idea.
Right. And they know that they're going to follow the market. Yeah.
Yeah. And it doesn't even mean that, like, at this point, the market's only down like 3 or 4%. Makes no sense to me. Well, it makes sense to me, but I know it's not sustainable. It's not even that they lost that much. It's that they, at some point, they lost a lot. And if their advisor didn't help them stay in or help them think it through, they lost a lot of trust.
So, but if you were right now, I know you would never be that person. But if you were stuck as a wealth advisor right now, and, you know, or an old school wealth advisor, what would be, you know, you say, okay, I want to innovate. What would be your first step? What would you do first?
First, I'd figure out my niche, my specialty, right? Like, what am I going to brand myself around? What is my value prop? Because most of financial advice is commoditized at this point. So once you figured that out, then you've got to build your brand around it. Like my social media presence, what is my, my voice that I want to, actually dedicate myself to being a specialist in, right? So like Terroso has always been that way. We're ETF specialists, right? And then that filters down to multiple different business lines. Once all that's done, I think it's just, it is somewhat of the old business of dials. Now, doesn't necessarily mean you're making 500 phone calls a day like the old days, but it's constantly connecting with as many people as you can get to and, you know, letting them hear your message, build trust. And once you've got trust, you can, trust is the only thing that justifies that 1% fee. All the rest of it is commoditized. You don't get scale without that trust.
Yeah, actually, one of the best wealth advisors conversations I had was a financial advisor that I met. He was based in Tampa. That he said, "I'm a financial advisor to nurses." I'm like, "Okay, I applaud you, and that's what everybody should be doing right now." And he's like, I love that because everybody just refers me. I don't need anything else because they know a lot of nurses. They work with other nurses and I just keep getting referrals.
Specialties work. So there's a think tank member. She works with women who've just gone through divorces.
Yeah.
Right. That's like her whole practice. Another one who works with young entrepreneurs that came out of crypto, right? Like, so he knows all the crypto language and then helps them learn the stock market language. Like there's so many of these multi-millionaires who've never bought a stock because they made their money in crypto. And like translating that for them from, you know, a fork versus a split, they're dealing with the opposite way, right? Financial people are trying to understand, is a fork the same as splitting shares? No. Okay, now try and explain a split to a guy who understands what a fork is. So like, but okay, yeah, specialties, I think, are the key.
We're going to do what I call like some rapid fire questions. So first.
Okay.
Tell me something that's true that almost nobody agrees with you on.
I know it's supposed to be rapid fire, but I don't. You don't have to convince me.
You just have to say what you believe.
Okay. All right. This time's not different.
This time, I love that. Yeah, of course. Room, desk, or car? Which one do you clean first?
Definitely my room because I share it with my wife and happy wife, happy life.
I should have added both there, right?
Yeah. Well, my kids clean the boat.
Oh, good.
Yeah, that's one of the chores.
Okay, so if you had time or we were willing to, what profession would you change to? What would you like to do?
I'd probably like to try law. I mean, I don't think I would recommend anybody go into it now, but like, it seems like such a interesting mix of social science with, like I don't know, I just love the idea that it's about finding facts, but it's not.
Yeah. Wow, I love you. That's good.
Yeah. I think I'd be a pretty decent lawyer.
Yeah, I would. I mean, you're very,
I think, until the ethical shit got to me, I'd enjoy it.
Okay, final one. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the gate, pearly gate?
I'd like him to stop laughing. One of my favorite jokes is, how do you make God laugh? And the answer is try to make a plan for your life. And so.
Yeah.
So if I get there, plan's over, you can stop laughing.
Oh, wow. I love it. Okay, Mike. Thank you so much. I had a lot of fun.
It was fun. It was good to talk to you. Stay safe.
You too.
All right.
Bye.